Sam, that's about 5 seconds. Let's get rid of that music and get into something concrete. We got another hour with Brent. Brent, we got a couple of folks that want to talk to us. I didn't even issue calls, but they've called in, and I want to get to them. And I was going to, if we covered enough ground here, take calls at the end. But I'd like for you to go into and explain just a little bit more in detail. For one thing, as you were talking about the common law, you know, you can look at the, say, the Code of Federal Regulations, for example, and see hundreds of thousands of pages, and they continue to add thousands every year, of man-made laws by unelected bureaucrats. Okay, now in the common law versus that, there's what, 8 major categories of crimes? Debt new. I mean, there's some subcategories there, but they're just 8. And give you an example, just for comparison's sake, you know, my 2 teachers spent 15 and a half years in federal prison. They prosecuted them to get them off the street because they had this information that you guys are getting now, okay? They charged Glenn with 90 different counts, and not one of them had anything to do with this, but they threw 90 counts. Common law, there's only 8.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Roger, it's the federal, what we call, what lawyers have called the federalization of criminal law. And that's the last big report I read on that was back, I believe, in 97 or 98. And Ed Meese was the head of the commission. He'd been attorney general during the days of Ronald Reagan. And his opinion was that the federalization of criminal law was out of control. And back then, that's been 25, 30 years ago. And it was, surely was. There are only 4 kinds of crimes that our Constitution mentioned, and they don't say much about them. Let's see if I can remember them here. There are felonies and piracies committed on the high seas, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States. And then there is, of course, treason. Treason's a big one, and it's defined very well. Our Constitution defines treason, and then violations of international law. That's it. That's all there are. That's all it mentions. But of those categories, it doesn't detail any crime except treason, and the Constitution of the United States goes to pains to define treason, because if treason, as Justice Story says in his commentaries on the Constitution, if treason isn't defined, it will become a political tool for men to destroy their political adversaries, as Tom Jefferson tried to do. He tried to use treason to destroy, to have hung, he wanted him hung, Aaron Burr. Didn't fly. I'm not down on Tom Jefferson, but I certainly recognize that men, there are no good men out there. There are just men. And God uses us in spite of ourselves. And Tom Jefferson was one of those fellows, and that was one of the black. There are other things about Tom Jefferson we could talk about that are important to know, because he's the one of the men that God used to help put our country on course. But it's good also to recognize his faults. He wasn't a god. And if we ever get the impression that these men that we call the founders and the framers and those fellows were without fault and we're not willing to talk about it, then we've committed the error of the law of the city. We have deified, right, made lawgivers out of these men, and they were anything but that. They had, George Washington, boy, the things you could say about him, good and bad. Just like you could say about me, Roger, good and bad. But I'm just thankful, Roger, that God's the only one that can make a straight lick with a crooked stick once in a while, and that's me. And you.
Well, that's me, too, buddy. Look at my background. I didn't get here through the exit door in the choir room, okay?
All I can do is laugh. I should be crying, probably. But, well, you'd mentioned
Be grateful. Be grateful, as I am, that later in life this crossed my path and it changed my life. You know, and it's because these legal lessons and these things all go back to a spiritual base, and you can't study one without the other. And I maintain the people that this is put in front of that don't get it are the ones that don't have a spiritual gene. Now, they may get it later. It may grow on them. But from the people that don't react to this over all these years, that's the one common denominator I've isolated.
Mm-hmm. Well, God must open a man's eye. God's the ultimate lawgiver. There is no appeal from him. And he says he opens men's eyes, and it's his discernment and his will that opens the ears. Him that has ears, let him hear. God, Jesus Christ, God himself throughout the Bible, whether you look at him as the Godhead or the members of the Godhead, they were only talking. The Bible's only written to them that have ears to hear. and eyes to see. It's not written to anybody else. And God.
That's why Jesus talked in parables.
You betcha. To hide. And he said, I'm hiding this from them because their punishment, their eternal hell, is so bad now, I don't want to make it any worse for them. Now, I can't explain all that. He said that. I can't explain all that, and I don't have to. He has revealed to me much. We're going through the book of Romans on Saturdays on, well, I won't mention the other platform here. But,
no, it's okay. Well, it's okay.
It is. Roger and I are on that platform, and that's Patriot Soapbox. And we're going through Romans, and Paul's epistle, Paul the Apostle's epistle to Romans, to the Christians at Rome, is his unpacking of the great gospel of God. He says that in the beginning. And he answers all of the questions that are mysterious to people. He answered them clearly and point blank. The clash of the sovereignty of God, the will of God with the will of man, and what that means and how it works and how God has established that and how he deals with it. And without understanding those fundamentals, you don't understand the will of God fundamentally. And to understand the will of God is to understand true law, because the law, the will of the sovereign is law, as you said, as we've said, Roger. Now, Roger, you said, Brent, you wanted me to tell something. I thought
I do. Well, I want you to go into a little bit of the comparative between the law of the city and the difference between the process and how they handle things.
But before you
launch off on that, and we take some of these callers that want to talk to us, I wanted to just add that, you know, John Benson was my law teacher. I've got a great deal of admiration for him. Okay, and he told us, his saying was, the law, the battle we fight today is the battle that's been going on since the beginning of time. And that battle is lex rex versus the common law, the law of man versus the law of God. It's the battle we're fighting right now.
Mm-hmm. And one of the Scottish reformers wrote a book called Lex Rex. And the point of his book was, his name was Rutherford, and that was back 500 years ago, in the 1500s, I believe. Yeah, it was. And Rutherford's point was, which comes first, lex, which is Latin for law, or rex, which is Latin for king? Is it lex rex or rex lex? Which is it? And it's a pretty, it's not a really thick book. I used to give copies of it away. I finally quit doing that. You give books away, people won't read them. Yeah. But I wanted people to read that book years ago. But what he says in there is that he examines the texts of the Bible that he thinks bear hard on that point, and he brings them around. He's lively on the Hebrew text, by the way. He liked to look at the Hebrew text, and he breaks it down, exegetes it, and he says this is clear. The king of Israel was a limited kingship. He wasn't an emperor. And by the way, the king of England is a limited kingship, too. You're talking about differences.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you've heard of the kowtow. Kowtow, this is part of our common law history. Back in the late 1700s, the first ambassadors from Britain went to China for the first time. And, of course, being there, the emperor of China wanted to see them, and they wanted to see him. So they got their best English clothes on with their cravats and all of their scallop vests and their whatever, wigs they used to wear, and got all gussied up, as my grandma Douglas used to say. Got all gussied up, and then the people that were wanted to give them fair warning said, "Now look, when you go in there, we'll let you in the doors." And there's marks on the floor, and every time as you're walking toward the emperor, when you come to a mark that looks a certain way, you have to fall on your face and do a spread eagle, and then you get up and you walk a little further, then you fall on your face and do a spread eagle. That's called kowtow in Chinese, kowtow. And they said, "What? Oh, we ain't doing that," they said. I forget what these fellows' names are. You can look them up. "We ain't doing that." "Why not?" "Well, no. Both knees in our country, both knees, go down on both knees is reserved for God alone. We'll go down on one knee before the king, but never both knees." You know, you see people traditionally in our English-speaking world at weddings, they'll sometimes be on both knees at the altar, the bride and the groom. That's because they're swearing to God. They're vowing to God. They're not vowing to each other. They're vowing to God. A vow is a promise made to God. You don't have to call God in to enforce it because you're talking to him as you're making the vow. An oath is a is calling God in to witness a promise you make to other men. Same idea, but a little bit different. You don't, you're asking God to bring his judgment upon you if you don't keep your promise. I hope that makes a lot of you out there feel guilty if you're married. That's the idea. It's a law of God, God says, that drives us to the Savior.
You know, bring guilt. Brent, you just said something that was really interesting to me. In the oath of fealty, the serf was on both knees in front of the Lord of the manor.
Well, yeah, that's not common law. That because that's acknowledging him as lawgiver, as from whose decision there is no appeal, a God. Well, these fellows wouldn't do that. And they said, look, if you don't get down spread eagle and do this, he could order his boys standing around there with them swords to lop your head off in your shoulders. Well, they said, we're not going to do it. And they became well known because they didn't do it. And fortunately, the emperor didn't have them killed. But that's an expression of our common law. And if you, even in modern days, you'll see men go down on one knee before Queen Lizzie, and two knees are reserved for who? God, well, you go in front of the Pope, what do? Well, he'll stick his toe out, and you got to lick his boots. That's what'll happen.
No, now, thank you.
No, I'm not in for that. Reasonable, dignified men of any honor wouldn't do that. As Fratcher used to say, and this is what this Englishman said that Henry VIII sent to the Pope. He said he wouldn't lick any man's boots. Matter of fact, the Pope stuck his toe out for him to kiss it or lick it or whatever you're supposed to do. And he had this little spaniel dog he'd brought all the way from England. He made the whole journey with him to Rome. He stuck his foot out for this fellow to kiss his foot, and the dog thought he was trying to kick his master and jumped forward and grabbed hold of the Pope's foot and like tore his toe off. Well, of course, the Pope tried to laugh it off, you know, and all the cardinals standing around, they tried to laugh it off too. But it hurt, for crying out loud, because that little dog, you know, dogs are faithful to their masters. How faithful would be to God that we would be as faithful to Jesus Christ as that little dog was to his master. That's
good
what he
analogy.
Wants. He doesn't want us to listen to people badmouth him, talk about, is he really God? I was talking a while ago about the Son of God. You know, in all cultures of the world, the emperor, the government, the single will that is without appeal, whoever it is, in Germany, they couldn't get away with calling Hitler a god, but he was de facto. There was no appeal from him. He stood in the place of Jesus Christ, just like the Pope says, hey, I'm not Jesus Christ. I stand in his place. Well, that's the definition of Antichrist.
I'm going to interrupt because you haven't given the audience a definition of lawgiver, and I think that's real important for what you're saying.
Yeah, a lawgiver. What is we call them gods for reasons of accident of history, and I'll talk about that a little bit too. In the Bible, it does that because of our Anglo-Saxon and our Anglo-Dane heritage. Our culture came from them, and I'll say something about that. But a God is a final decider. Whoever you take for your final decider of right and wrong in individual instances, from whose decision there is no appeal, is your God. Everybody's got one. I ask people. It's a toll I've been taking for 40 years. You got religion, I'll say? Be in the gas station. Some young fella, tattoos all over his body. Some big bruiser of a guy. I'll say, give him the money. Hey, you got religion? He'll say, no, I ain't got no religion. I don't believe in it. Oh, I think you're mistaken. I'll say, why's that? Well, somebody's got to decide right and wrong for you. I suspect it's probably yourself. In a lot of cases that nobody knows about, you're secretly deciding right from wrong, and you're not allowing any appeal. And I said, you're your own God. I said, that's stupid. I said that the other day. I thought I'd get away with it. That's stupid, because whoever your lawgiver is, the stronger he is, the stronger you will be. The weaker he is, the weaker you will be. Why not go straight to the top? Not the maker of this, that, or the t'other, they're claiming he's a maker of something, but the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is. Who is that? Well, the Bible tells us. That's Jesus Christ. And if anybody wants to know why I believe the Bible is good evidence for what it says, why it's reliable evidence, well, you can go to commonlawyer.com. That's www.commonlawyer.com. And there's a book there, Roger, that you and I are familiar with, Excellence of the Common Law, Comparative Law Text, Comparing and Contrasting the Law of the Land and the Law of the City. 958 pages, and there's a long appendices in the back saying why we can know this evidence called the manuscripts of the Older Testament and the Newer Testament, why we can know as a matter of evidence, applying the common law rules of evidence, how we know they're reliable. Listen, if what the Bible says is true, all I want to know is, what does it say and what do I do? I'm really convinced it's true, and it's reliable, and it's without error, how do you know that? Are there ways to know? Yes, under the rules of evidence, you can know.
The audience needs to know that you've translated your own Bible. How long have you been working on it, 40 years?
Well, now over 40 years. I'm thinking back, it'd be, well, yeah, working consistently at that for about 41 years. And it's a process. Once you start doing it, you just think of better ways to get it across. And
it's a lifetime endeavor.
And with the internet, that's more doable than it's ever been. As far as I know, Roger, and I don't say this as a matter of boasting in myself, but boasting in those folks that have shown me how to do this, and boasting in the folks that have provided the platforms on the internet that enable the tabulation of information that the translators of the English Bible before never had, I can now go through, and I'm doing it, and I have done it, and every Hebrew root word, no matter whether it's in the verb form or the noun form or the adverb form or the participle form, whatever form it's in, I translate that Hebrew root with the same English root word. That way I know when I look at it, this translation's for me. I use it when I teach. When I look at a word in the Bible, whether it's a Hebrew word of the Older Testament or a Koine Greek word from the Newer Testament, I know what the Greek or the Hebrew word is, and that's why I've done it this way, and I continue to try to work it down. The other day, little things you don't think about. The other day, I was translating again through, I try to do so much every day and just keep at it. I was translating through a passage in Genesis, and I came to the word manservant and maidservant. And I said, I've got them hyphenated. I said, I wonder if those are really hyphenated words. And so I looked them up, and I found out they weren't. But I hyphenated them out of habit because the Hebrew text doesn't hyphenate them. It's just in the masculine gender and the feminine gender, but it means man or woman in that case. And I found out that the custom in English is that you shouldn't hyphenate them. You could, doesn't hurt anything, but I try to make it as tight as I can. I got rid of those hyphenations. Little things like that constantly coming across. And then every once in a while, like you said, Roger, the more information you take in, the tighter that your research becomes, your knowledge, the more your subconscious conscience kicks in on any given point. And that's what's happening to me now. You know, we were talking about that translation. I've talked about many translations of the Bible. I think of this one fellow, Rotherham. He said he didn't read anything but Greek and Hebrew for 10 years before he translated the Bible.
Wow.
Well, the other day I said, well, shucks, I haven't read the Bible in anything but Greek or Hebrew for more than 10 years now. And I can't make it perfect, but I do want to get the point across so I know what it's saying. You know, the mark of a good Bible translation, and this is for me, friends. People say, why do we need another translation, Brent? Well, this is for me, and anybody that's teaching the Bible and does not endeavor to translate it is sinning. Because it's your job, if you're teaching the Bible, that whatever you can find out, get in there and try to find out what you can about the original text of the Bible. You can get the black and white picture with the English text, no question. No question. But the color that the Hebrew and the Aramaic in some places in the Older Testament and the Koine Greek from the New Testament bring to the law of God, the revelation of what He wants, His will. What does He want? Well, let's try one here. It says He desires all men to be saved, to be safened from eternal hell.
All right. Well, we're going to be safened by a little break, so hold that. We'll be back. You guys on hold, we're going to get to you, I promise, in a second. So hang in there. We'll see you in a minute.
Consider this. dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. While we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country, here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719 extension 3. 800-724-2719 extension 3.
All right, Sam, let's get back to business here, man. I got Brent Winters with me, my friend and broadcast partner. Brent, because of the limitations of time, and I don't want to leave these people hanging on the phone, what I was wanting you to get across, too, is this comparison between the law of the city and the common law. And, buddy, if we don't have a Sterling, probably the best example in our country's history of a law of the city trial where it's determining the outcome and not the process, it's Alex Jones.
Good point, Roger. And that's the one of the great differences. Our common law is process-oriented, and the law of the city is result-oriented. Well, the law of the city says we must reach the result that the powers that be command by their legislation. The law of the land says, no, we're going to focus on the process, like the Bible says, and let the chips fall where they may out here at the other end. That's right, Roger. Good point.
Yeah. Yep, that's why they hate the common law, and they've gotten you away from it by this little trick of getting you to volunteer into fraudulent voluntary servitude. So, Brent, there's probably some other folks who want to call in. I love talking to the audience. I know you do, too. So without getting too far afield here, Sam, could you who we got first here that's been waiting so long? Hopefully it's not Tim. Okay. As long as it's not Tim from Washington, that'll be all right. Go ahead. Richard, you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't hear my name.
Hey, Richard.
Basically, great presentation. What I've found, and I kind of explained this on a program before you, is man has the ability to rationalize and justify, and the only way you can kind of get around that is by pursuing objective reality instead of subjective reality, by studying historical foundations, which you've been presenting very, very well today. And to go earlier, law started with the law of Hammurabi, which was Babylonian,
right,
and then went to the law of Justinian, which was Roman and Latin, coming out of the Greeks. And then with Constantine, he passed the ownership of the world from the Caesareans to the Bishop of Rome, and we incorporated that with the law of Moses. I believe that's essentially historical foundation. Is there any argument to that?
No, I want to add a couple of things, though. The Code of Hammurabi is real important. If you go back, I've got a great resource on my sovereigntosurf.com, all spelled out, Sovereign to Surf. And there's a book over there that was published in the 1930s by John Hopkins. It's called Historical Jurisprudence. Have you heard me talk about that, Robert? You may want to read it. It is the first 90 pages. It's a book on historical jurisprudence. But the first 90 pages are all on the Babylonian Merchant Code. And it's a real in-depth view of the Babylonian Merchant Code, which is the law of the city basis. And what's important to understand is that the origin evidently was with the Sumerians. It was the Babylonians that perfected it, is my understanding.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. And then we came to America, and these people were trying to get away from both the king and the pope's influence. So in their own documents, the Declaration of Independence, they said the law of nature and nature's God.
Correct.
And I kind of question, because you said, well, Blackstone defined that. Well, I don't think that definition was accurate. The law of nature is something like gravity.
Okay, right. These would be my example, too.
Yeah. These are things that we create as theses, and then because they're true almost all of the time, hardly ever an exception except for extreme circumstances, they become laws of nature. And then it was nature's God. Most of the founding fathers were deists. They didn't believe in, quote-unquote, biblical construct of God. They believed in the nature's God, the creator of nature. At least that's my interpretation of historical foundation. And as pointed out in the last program, Clint Richardson points out that the Bible is a legal manual for the individual. And we assumed Christianity by way of Constantine from the Essenes, and that was the origin of their law, which was basically the law of Moses elaborated in the New Testament. But what you find is all three, religion, law, and government, which you said, you know, are the foundations, these are man-made institutions to control the citizens. That's their background. You go to people like Jordan Maxwell and many others. There's a great book called The Old-Time Religion by Jordan Maxwell, Paul Tice, Alan Snow, and Gerald Massey, and you find out some of the things you've been pointing out. All of this of the creator comes from the son, S-U-N, is transferred to the S-O-N, and the Bible is nothing more than a presentation of astrological theology that's been reinterpreted from an anthropomorphic perspective. And if you want to read a great book, you read a book called Mythology's Last Gods by William Harwood. It's the study of the last myths of Yahweh and Jesus. And I'll read like a little bit of that because it's really pertinent. More than 100 years ago, historians began applying critical methods of documentary analysis to the Judeo-Christian Bible. To scholars who had hoped to prove the Bible's authenticity, the results were dramatic. One by one, the various books of the Bible were discovered to contain errors of fact, inaccurate guesses, rationalizations, prophecies ex post facto, usually combined with prophecies of the future that proved inaccurate, and unmistakable, deliberate lies. Such was the power of the church that despite the publication of thousands of scholarly books and articles refuting every part of the Judeo-Christian Bible, to this day the existence of unchallengeable proof that the Bible is a work of fiction is unknown to 90% of the population of Christian dominated societies. So basically, if you're going to go by true factual information, true objective reality, you're going to realize that God is a mythological creation, and is Jesus a mythological creation, to present the theology and the man-made religion that controls the people. I don't want to be controlled, and why I found that the way to step out of control is to understand that the law of the land now is the UCC. And
well,
I could recommend
that's
a book.
Well, and, of course, that's the Babylonian Merchant Code under another label.
Exactly. And there's a great presentation by Howard Freeman that's summed up in a little pamphlet called the UCC Connection. When you understand that, and you understand the capability of writing under your signature without prejudice, UCC 1-308, that gives you essentially a tie that limits the jurisdiction and ties you to the common law, or allows you to tie yourself to the common law.
It allows you to access it. If you'll file an affidavit, you can have it all the time without putting that under your signature, by the way.
Exactly, and that's the point. You know, everybody, you know, has very different perspectives as to how to actually prevent yourself from coming under jurisdiction. But to me,
you're under the jurisdiction from birth. There isn't no coming out from under it. That's why no patriots can ever win a jurisdictional argument at the base level in a district court.
Exactly, because once you go into court, you should prevent that. Once you go into court, they are talking to the birth certificate. And what you do is you take a birth certificate in that court, and when they require you to be present before them, you haven't gone into the bar, you throw the birth certificate in there and say, you know, here's who you're asking for, you know, please have a conversation. I'm leaving.
Do you know that there are jurisdictional statements in the first paragraph of every federal charges that are brought to you? You know what it is?
Go.
Richard from Washington, a resident of, you don't dispute it, the presumption of law rolls. It's right there in the first paragraph, every lawsuit brought by the feds. That's their jurisdictional statement. Nothing to do with, you can't bring a birth certificate into that level and get any justice, because the level that you got to deal with is at the top in the Secretary of State. He's got the master say-so here.
Exactly. So when I am ever approached by anybody with authority and they say, what's your name? I am one of the people, capital P.
Yeah.
And then they say, well, no, that's not your name. And I go, oh, I'm sorry, you're right, I'm Gregory Freeman. And they go, well, is that on your birth certificate? I say, you know, if you want to talk to the birth certificate, here is my birth certificate. And I'm an agent for that birth certificate, because I've actually filed a UCC form to make myself an agent for the all capital letters in my name. And you know, usually it stops there, but eventually you have to present yourself in court, and that's been my response for that.
Okay. The way you avoid yourself getting into court is to file it with the Secretary of State and put everybody on notice that it's been filed with him, and they'll never bring you in there.
Exactly. I mean, there's ways to actually go through the legal paper trail perspective, and you've presented those very well. And you know, most people don't understand that. They cloud the issues, and you know, a lot of people say, well, God and Jesus are the ones, you know, that are in control. You know, when you study the factual historical information, you realize that that's how we got deceived right from the start. Rome started, first of all, by essentially taking control over us with our status as citizens, and then it created bread and circuses, which was the elimination of enzymes in a nutritional perspective, and then it divided us and conquered us, and it created diversions to do that with circuses, and the last and biggest straw in that thing was the creation of religions, or the orientation around religions, and that's where we really went astray. It's just a subjective reality, but I think
it's been known for thousands of years that religion can be the opiate of people. I don't stress religion. I stress spirituality here.
Exactly.
I'm sure Brent's got something to say, but I wanted to just say, have you heard me, and this is my teacher's John's information, of how the Jus Civil turned into the Jus Gentium? Those are the two distinct laws of Rome, the Jus Civil being the first 200 years, a common law type setting, into the Jus Gentium, or the law of the foreigner. Do you know how that took place?
No, I don't, but that's always the dualism that's created to divide the people.
Correct. Correct. Well, first of all, the merchant law has all of these intricate ways of dealing with financial transactions. The common law lacks that, so it's almost a magnet for it when you think about it. But in those days, and Brent and I have talked about this, Rome for the first 200 years was run under a system of called the Ten Tablets, like the Ten Commandments. Now, we don't know what they said, but we knew they existed, and that was the guiding principle in those days. As Rome grew and took in foreign territories, the merchants in the foreign territories, wanting to go where the action was, would go to Rome, but they brought with them their merchant law. Okay? And so the Roman
today
is
the UCC.
Yes, it is. And so what the Roman citizens that had been under more or less a common law saw was the merchants brought in a real easy way to remedy and not have to go into a complex, long court process with a jury and evidence and getting a judgment and getting it registered before they could get their remedy. And they saw the merchants having this stuff called self-help remedies. You've heard me refer to them on here. They're very important. And most people may not understand what that is, self-help remedies from the master label. But if I said lien, levy, garnishment, and seizure, you know exactly what they are, okay? And that is a form in the merchant law where the remedy is written into the contract. And if you don't perform due to the contract, they can go out and execute the remedy because you've already agreed to it, okay? And the Roman citizens saw the foreign merchants with this easy way of remedy of a contract, and so the attorney general of Rome was called a praetor. The Romans were smart enough, and they knew how much power that office generated. You mean, later on, the emperors were changed by the Praetorian Guards, okay? And so they were smart enough to change a praetor every year. And most praetors would follow the body of law that the previous praetors had followed. They might make minor changes. But over a period of 200 years, under the legal fiction that a citizen of Rome was a foreign merchant, they included the Babylonian merchant code into the Roman jus civil, and it became the jus gentium, and we call that today the United States Code. Same thing.
Exactly, and all law, especially the UCC, has to have relief and remedy, and as soon as you understand that, you try to avoid getting involved in it, but as soon as you understand that's your salvation.
And I have come to the conclusion that these self-help remedies are the first harbingers of terrorism and the control of the government, because that's what they exercise first to put fear into you. Because when those things start happening to you, you automatically attribute these people with all this power and you cower in the corner, and they've achieved their purpose.
Well, that's
so
it.
So, Brent,
advantage of the Bible.
Right. Well, I'm sure Brent disagrees with a couple of the points you made, and I wanted to give him a chance to address
it. Well, that's it. What the Bible says is, in the midst of wolves, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Go ahead.
Right. Well, hold on. Both of you are talking. Brent, go ahead.
Well, the truth is, I didn't hear anything he said, because apparently the way it's set up, somehow it doesn't come through to me what he said.
Oh, no. You didn't get to hear the question?
No, I didn't hear the question, but I do have an idea of some of the things he said from your comments, and some of the things he apparently has said are common complaints, and I could respond to them. One of the things he apparently addressed was religion, and religion is the opiate of the people, which is what the communists used to say, of course, probably still do, but I don't know what he said about it. I should ask, maybe you could boil it down for me.
Well, I don't know if I could boil it down, because he said a lot, but he wasn't totally in agreement with you and I. And the one thing that comes to me, well, he can't hear you. Okay, that's the problem. But let me just
tell him that what I believe is that religion is anthropomorphized, quote unquote, mythology, and when we take that mythology and make it real, make it quote unquote, not subjective, but objective, we essentially step out of our jurisdiction.
Okay.
As people.
He said the Bible and religion is basic mythology, but what I was going to bring out, and I know Brent's research because we've done so many shows together, much of it anyway, and he brought out a very interesting thing lately about Sodom and Gomorrah. Do you know that scientists have gone over there and they found sulfur bound up with magnesium, and it's the only place in the world they've ever found it like that?
Are you asking me or him?
No, I'm telling him.
Oh, Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's true. There's no question. But let me get to the point.
Hold on. He can't hear you talking. We've let you talk for a bit. Let Brent talk for a second, please.
Yeah. Okay. I can't hear him either. That's why we're conflicting. But
Sam, can Sam figure out why he can't hear the caller? Okay. Just a question to Sam. Go ahead, Brent.
I've never talked to anybody that says that. A lot of people say what he said. Oh, it's all mythology. That is common. But I've never talked to anybody that says that knows anything about it. They don't know diddly squat about the Bible. They couldn't recite the books in order if they had to. They don't know who the characters are. They don't know the sweep and flow of it. But beyond that, as I said a while ago, the evidence is clear. It's a matter of evidence. All of life is objective fact evidence. Everything we do has to be based on evidence if we're going to get anywhere. And when it comes to the Bible, the evil man, the one whose eyes is not open, who is trapped by his own sin and viciousness, wound up and bound up in his own difficulties and whims, and that includes everybody at some point in their life, they will deny the Bible. Why? Because the Bible sets a standard from their Maker that makes them guilty and uncomfortable. Let's get to the bottom line here. That's what this is about. It always is. Those that rail against God's word are railing against God. I get away from them. They're dangerous. The judgment's going to fall on them. And I don't want to be close, because God promises the judgment will fall if he does not open their eyes at some point. And people say, well, that's not logical. I didn't say it was. I'm talking about the revelation of God. There are a lot of things we have as evidence in life that we don't understand. We don't understand what makes gravity work, but we sure know it works. We don't understand what makes a seed germinate. I grew up on the farm. We planted seeds. I began to ask myself questions as I was growing up. How does this work? This seed is dead. I've studied it. I've read about it. There is no biologist in the world that can tell you why a seed germinates. They can say, well, it's the moisture that causes it. Yeah, but still, how does life come from something that is clearly, otherwise, by all standards, dead? This is the mystery of life. We know the facts of things because the evidence is clear to us. But we cannot
found
explain.
Flax seed. Do you know they found flax seeds in the mummies that sprouted thousands of years old?
I've taken seeds that my great-granddad had put in a fruit jar and planted them, and they grew, and that had been 70, 80 years before. That's not unusual, and that doesn't surprise me. I've heard what you're saying is true. But no, let's get to the bottom line. Here, I'm looking, Roger, about the Code of Justinian, for example. I talked about the Code of Justinian. That is the Bible of Rome. That is the Bible of the Roman Empire. The emperor was God. The Bible's not their Bible. That's not the final rule of faith and practice to a Romanist. No, the Holy Father hath said that ends it. He's the final rule from whose decision there is no appeal. But did you know, did I know, did anybody know, when they told us, oh, we're based on the Roman law, but the Roman law wasn't even translated into English until 1932. Nobody cared. Oh. Nobody in America cared. And the first fellow to translate it into English was a German immigrant that served on the Supreme Court of the state of Wyoming for 40-some years. He came over here as a 12-year-old boy. He was wanting to look at it, and he discovered, after writing letters all over the country, that it had never been translated into English. Now, isn't that something? And lawyers will tell you, our law is based on the Roman law. Is that right? Oh, the founders, they understood Rome. Is that right? Oh, Jefferson had a copy of it in his library. Yeah, it was in Latin. He couldn't read Latin that well, and you couldn't really get out of it what you get in English. But nobody cared, and still, people care less today about the Roman Code. Lawyers in America, that they don't even read it, and there has been no interest in it since this fellow's name was Frederick Heinrich Blume. He translated it into English. Nobody's cared since. That's how much we care about the law of the city, the law of the evil empires of Babylon. And that's what that law is. As John Wycliffe said, the first man to translate the Bible into English in the 14th century, he said, the laws of the city, the civil canon laws of Rome, are evil men's laws. Why? Because they enable men to worship men, to make gods out of men. That's why Hitler wanted it. That's why Bismarck took it in, and it became the official law of Germany. You know, before Bismarck, about 1900, Saxony was still a common law jurisdiction. And the lawyers there followed the fundamental principles of the common law that is now practiced in America and England. Martin Luther is the one that encouraged the electors of Germany to take on the Roman law. And again, Martin Luther was a peach of a fella, did a lot of brave things, risked his life, translated the Bible into German. But he wasn't God either. He made mistakes, and of course, I can't judge him, having not lived in his time when it was a life and death matter, whether you were a Protestant or a Romanist. They'd kill you if you left the Roman Church, if you left as a nun, if you left as a priest. Your life wasn't worth much. By the way, it still isn't in many parts of the world. But the only struggle that mankind has had from the founding of the city of Babylon and the other cities of the plain, which you talked about a while ago, the only struggle among mankind is the law of the land versus the law of the city. That's it. The history of England, clearly, I'm just reading here about Bloom. I wanted to look up some things about him. And one of the books that he read, and I would recommend this set of books outside the Bible, this is a good set of books. It's the history of the Reformation in England. That's one of the books that was foundation to him understanding the struggle between the law of the land and the law of the city. It was a bestseller in England back in the 1850s when it was first published, written, by the way, by a Frenchman who was fascinated by what went on in England, because the Reformation in England was different than all of the continent of Europe, the Lutheran Reformation, the Reformed Reformation of the Dutch states and Frisia and all those places. In England, it was not just a Reformation of the church. That's what it was on the continent. But in England, it was a Reformation of not only the church, but of government, because of the common law in England. And we came to our common law, we keep restating it. Long before Magna Carta, the laws of Edward the Confessor. Before him, the Mutmaltine laws of the 5th century in England. And after him, after Alfred the Great in the 9th century, then Edward the Confessor. The laws of Edward the Confessor are restating. And then, of course, Magna Carta, 1215, June the 15th. And then after Magna Carta, the reissuance. Edward I reissued Magna Carta to affirm to the people of England that these principles he wanted to uphold. And then we have the Declaration of English Rights and the Bill of Rights of England, 1628. The Civil War of England, what was that all about? That was the law of the land versus the law of the city. The king said, I am the law, I'm God in England. And Parliament said, no, you aren't. The Parliament was controlled by the Puritans. The Puritans of that time were flocking to New England, not to get away from England only, but to rule England from New England. These were men of means. This wasn't a joke. They didn't flee just to flee. No, they said, we can't get this under control here. We've tried it. 80,000 men died in the English Civil War. It didn't work. Why? Because the Scots, who were enamored with the French, and the Scottish Covenanters took over Parliament with the Puritans. The Puritans then, they went back and said, well, after they chopped Charles's head off, we want his son to come back. And then he was the tyrant that his father was. And then they got rid of him. And then they invited William and Mary to come and rule. And on the struggle goes. And we're going through that struggle right now in America. What do you see? Go ahead.
And William and Mary brought the Jews back. Richard, thank you. I think it was Richard. We took up a lot of time. I don't want these people to run out.
I just would make one last challenge. Read The Mythology's Last Gods by William Harwood. It started out as a dissertation in college. If you can read that and still have your beliefs, I'm impressed.
Okay, well, I doubt the print has
I'd
time.
Have to think that I would have.
Did you hear
I
that?
I would have to think that. Yes, I heard that one. I would have to think that he was a reliable source. But nothing he has written will compare to the reliability of the manuscripts of the Older and the New Testament. I mean, anybody could jump up and write a book about philosophy and slam the truth. And people do it. They've been doing it for centuries. Many of them are very logical, but they got their facts wrong because they don't pay attention to the laws of evidence. Evidence is about fact, not logic. Logic will not get you to the truth. That's scholasticism. That's Rome. That's Islam. That's Judaism. That's scholasticism. We're talking about fact here. Go ahead, Roger.
Well, I was just going to say I wanted to get these other callers. They've been holding a long time. We spent a lot of time with Richard, so thank you for calling. Who's next, Sam? Terry in Texas. Thanks, come on aboard, Terry. How you doing? Sorry to make you hold so long, friend.
Hey, Roger and Brent. Hope you guys can hear me.
Yep.
I had a question concerning status, citizenship, and if you look at the rally of January 6th, and all those people that are being held in jail, if they would have legally filed their status change,
they would have never charged. They'd have never charged them.
You believe that? Yes, sir.
I do, and you know why? Because they don't want that coming up in court.
Okay. Okay.
That's why none of you that do this, and, you know, I stress learning the information. Your freedom's in the information. It's not filing a piece of paper. It's not paying somebody to do it for you. Mm-hmm. Your freedom's going to be internalizing this information and being able to belligerently stand on your decision, okay? As Judge Learned Hand said, to protect one, I'm paraphrasing, to protect one's rights, one must be a belligerent claimant. You can't be a belligerent claimant unless you know the information. Okay, well, we got Terry here whipping a break on us already, man. We're going to get in the last little segment here, and I'll hold you over and see if we answered that in a second, okay? So thank you. We'll be right back.
Are you sick of censorship? TLB Talk is the cure. TLB stands for Truth, Liberty, and Balance. We are the newest and most unique social media platform to hit the internet. We were built out of necessity because Big Tech, Big Pharma, and Big Brother are out of control. The only thing bigger than them is when we, the people, are united. With that vision, TLB Talk was born. Our battlefield is in cyberspace. The battle we're in can be won by clicks of buttons and voting with your wallet. TLB Talk has no hidden agendas, no corporate funding, and we do not sell, trade, or give away any of your information. Our platform runs off of generous donations of members and merchandise profits. So please, check out our site. It's the best around. And be sure to stop by our store. It's loaded with items that'll have you feeling a sense of member pride and victory. Come unite with us today at tlbtalk.com and join the social media revolution.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back, to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
Time's precious here. Pipe it down. Terry, we got Terry and Brent with us. Terry, did we answer your question there?
Yeah, sure did. I had another question, but you're short on time. I think I'll just call your show during the week and get that answered.
Okay, I was going to say, if any of you want to talk to Brent and I, we're on every Friday. Okay, very rarely have we ever missed one. You're welcome to join us and ask questions over there if we didn't get to you today, okay?
Yeah. Just a little note, I noticed that the medical workers in New York won a $10 million lawsuit against the hospital for wrongful termination.
Fantastic. Well, wait till you see this Texas state court decision on Alex Jones get appealed over to the Fifth Circuit. You wait till you see what happens over there, okay?
Okay, it should be interesting, yeah.
Oh, yeah, so, they're conservative. The fur's going to fly on that travesty, because that's what it is. It's a travesty.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
So let me see. Thank you, Terry. Let me make sure if there's anybody else I wanted to get in his tail gunners here, if we can. Oh, Murr. Okay, Murr. Come on, girl. How you doing?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I'm the tail gunner. Yeah, I want to get this in really quick. And it's a good thing you didn't hear Richard, Brent, because you would be hailing him for blasphemy all up and down the place, okay? And he would deserve every bit of it. This man...
Thank you, Murr.
In Chris Hinckley's show and talking about enjoying nature and snowshoeing, he followed up with, "She's worshiping nature." And I had to call back. I said, "No, I'm enjoying creation. I worship the creator." This is the thing. People think religion is it. No, religion is man-made for control. We are
That's
spiritual
right.
beings. You have to know him in spirit, the way, the truth, and the life. And in 322 A.D., Constantine and his mother Helen went and found Simon Magus bones, skull and bones, skull and crossbones, femurs, and put them in the, what do you call it, in Jerusalem, sarcophagus there. I can't think of the name right now. But anyway, the Bible was inspired. These other books are men. They are part of creation. They aren't the creator. I don't know why this is so hard for people to get through their heads. And once someone does, very often they turn apostate and they get very angry. So learn the truth, people.
I heard a guy the other day being interviewed on SGT Report who was a confirmed atheist, and he started studying the Bible and converted.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I doubt Richard has read the Bible. He quoted one verse, but I doubt he's really read and studied the Bible.
Well,
people can read the Bible and not get it, but you have to ask for guidance and study it.
Yep. Yep.
Thank you, Mer.
Thanks,
guys.
You're always a little ray of sunshine. Thank you. Brent, again, if anybody wants to question us and didn't get to you. Sam, there's anybody else waiting or not? Okay, well, if anybody wants to ask us a question, every Friday we're there and it's open, and we talk about these subjects in depth, just like we, you know, did here tonight. And I hope y'all have gotten some basics and some foundations on this stuff, a little bit of a handle you may not have had before, and that was the intent of tonight, and I hope we accomplished that. Brent, I want to thank you for being with me, and I want to ask you, now that I got you on the spot here, and next Sunday on Patriot Soapbox, Thumper, who I'm usually with, has got way too many toys. A man with three Harleys has got too many toys, okay?
He's
taken off on one of them to go to Sturgis, and he may not be back. And so you asked me to take that 2 hours. Could I impose on you to stick around after your church service, and let's get into some of this law stuff there?
I heard you mention that at the end of Thumper's show, and I said to myself, I want to do that, and so we're good, and let's plan doing it together best
all
I can.
Great. Yeah, I'll look forward to it.
Thanks for inviting me. And by the way, Roger, if anybody does come on the show with Roger and I, and they speak in a blasphemous way, I'll do all I can to shut them down. And good thing I didn't hear that guy, because when I am on the radio or on a platform, it's my responsibility to not tolerate that kind of talk, because it's what God hates. It misleads people. You want to talk that kind of tripe and trash? When I talk about blasphemy, I'm talking about slander. That's what blasphemy is. It's slandering God. That won't be allowed in my presence without a fight. You shut your mouth and go someplace else. Or maybe the host would have to shut me out. I don't know. But I don't want to be around it. I don't want to be where the judgment falls. And not only that, I do not want to brook that kind of evil. Because brooking it, allowing it, is to join in it. The Bible's clear on that point. But myrrh, it's more than logic. It's more than just reading it. No, God has to open your eyes. Their eyes are closed. It's not up to me to open them. It's not my job. It's my job to speak the truth of the fact, Roger. So thanks again for having me on, and for Sam for letting me on. Thank you.
I want to be able to tell the audience who may not have been familiar with you, exposed to you before, how they can get more Brent Winters, and why don't you tell them?
Go to www.commonlawyer.com. That's commonlawyer.com. We're beginning a course. We have a law school going. It's been going for a number of years. We teach courses. We've called it a law school now, Winters Inn. And we're teaching a course on the four boxes of liberty. We've just finished a course, 12 weeks, on drafting a common law trust. We've had courses on contracts and evidence, etc. But this one's going to be the four boxes of liberty: the ballot box, the jury box, the cartridge box, that's the Second Amendment, and the soap box, that's the First Amendment, freedom of speech. Sheriff Darleaf. Sheriff Darleaf will be co-presenter with me.
Okay, well, you hear the whistler there, so our time's over. I hope y'all got something out of today. We'll see you next Sunday, if not before. Bye-bye.
Didn't America learn anything from McCarthyism? I'm Peter Serafin with today's Liberty Minute. From 1950 to 1954, Senator Joseph McCarthy led congressional hearings and investigations searching for communism. With little evidence, Senator McCarthy ruined careers with wild accusations and televised congressional hearings. That should sound familiar. Since 2016, Representative Adam Schiff has been doing the same thing, except instead of looking for
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.